hope. I want to donate my time, money, and efforts to continue this amazing 60 plus years of honest, open, trustworthy, independent radio.
Priscilla Kankar is a recent graduate of the Teachers College at Columbia University. She recently brought her expertise in social media, website development, and organizing voter data to a local city council campaign as digital director. Priscilla says she's aware of the serious impact of privatization of public and community resources. She hopes to bring community-oriented, uncensored local news on this station. To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org. All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
And it is slightly after midnight. You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Up next, a brand new episode of A Mansion for the Rat with Anne-Marie Hendrickson. Stay tuned.
All of my playmates is now surprised. I had to travel before I got wise. I found out better, and I'm still got my girl is with.
Good evening. It is Tuesday, a little after midnight here in New York City. You are listening to WBAI New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network, listener-sponsored radio network, 99.5 on your dial. My name is Anne-Marie Hendrickson, and the name of the show is A Mansion for the Rat. I apologize for my voice. I have a terrible sore throat. It's probably as painful for you to listen to as it is for me to talk. But, I mean, it's nothing too serious. It's not COVID. I certainly have my sense of smell, etc. It's really just a cold. I have the sore throat version of a cold, I guess. And before I go any further, I will remind you that when I said that this is listener-supported radio, it is indeed listener-supported radio, meaning we need support from you, the listeners, if we are to keep this going without, taking commercials. So I ask that you either call 209-2950. That's 209-2950. And that is our pledge line, telephone pledge line, or go to WBAI.org and click on the box that explains how to donate and become a member. $25 makes you a full paid-up member for a whole year. You can vote in everything. The other thing that you could do is you could become a buddy of the station, a buddy of mine, a buddy of my show, a buddy of any show. I don't want to be difficult about this. And the minimum amount for that, if you are able, if you're, you're working again and have the money, is $10 a month, which is like being a sustaining member. You become a buddy, a pal of WBAI and of A Mansion for the Rat. And that's good because we just send the money is, deducted from your bank account or your credit card, and we get the money rolling in every month. And every month or every week when you hear me making this plea, you know that you've done your part. And you know that you've helped the whole station stay on the air. And isn't that what we all want, the station to stay on the air? Yes, of course we do. Okay, on to the show. And tonight I'm going to do a variant on what has become my annual little rant about Columbus Day and what I think should be done with the problem of Columbus Day. And my solution is not like anyone else's, at least that I've heard. I wish that If so, I wish somebody would contact me about it. But I will talk a little bit about that, about the history of the holiday, such as it is. And I will be playing a fascinating episode of The Cavalcade of America, which went on the air on October 1942, right during the war. then based on the Columbia called Admiral of the Ocean Sea, based more or less on the Samuel Eliot Morison biography that had won the Pulitzer Prize, I think, earlier that year or the previous year. And it is, well, I'll get to it, but wow. I mean, I just listened to it this afternoon after it was suggested to me by my engineer, Max Schmid. And it is different from what I was expecting. It's all kinds of interesting things about it, which I will explain later, as I said. And so yesterday was Columbus Day / Indigenous Peoples Day. And so another, and this year it was a little more, the conflict was a little more heated because I believe that President Biden has actually named it Indigenous Peoples Day now, and it's still a holiday. But around these parts and at every part of the country where you have a substantial Italian population, it is still very much celebrated as Columbus Day. I think the one in the Columbus Day Parade in New York is the biggest one. And, I mean, clearly this argument is going to drag on for a while. I don't know how it's going to go, at least in places, like I said, like New York, where, you know, there's a fairly good-sized Italian community that feels strongly that they want Columbus Day to remain. Outside of this part of these places, I don't know how many people will stand up that strongly for Columbus Day. I mean, I think they want the paid holiday. I'm very big on the paid holiday idea of it, and I think I've mentioned more than once that one of the things that came up when I was working for the New York Public Library in the negotiations that the union had with the management was the New York Public Library, being of course a fine liberal institution, argued really hard on the bargaining table that we should give up a paid holiday, and the one that they thought we should give up was Columbus Day because it's a holiday celebrating genocide. And why would you ever like go to the wall and really defend your, you know, what you see as your right to have a paid holiday celebrating genocide? Because of course they'll always try to, you know, liberal guilt you out of, you know, what they really owe you. I mean, just the idea that, I mean, it's just so absurd. But I love that. That's just, you know, so typical. So if it does become Indigenous Rights Day, of course, it'll be harder to make that argument, won't it? But I shall not cease from mental fight on this one. I don't like the idea of this becoming, I mean, it's many people celebrate it already, especially I know in many Indigenous groups already do a lot of ceremonies on this day and consider it Indigenous Peoples Day. But I think one day is not enough. I would shift everything over to November and go for really solidifying that as Indigenous Peoples Month and really focus on Thanksgiving as Indigenous Peoples Culture Day, since that's already what that holiday is about. Perhaps in an aspirational way that many people find, you know, phony in an attempt to just sort of gloss over, you know, the genocide and the land grabs and the breaking of treaties and all the other, you know, crap that Native people have put up with since first contact. And yet I do feel that simply because it is sort of a celebration of mutual aid between European settlers and Native Americans, that there's more to build on there. Because if you acknowledge that there is a place of mutual aid and cultural respect, that also, it does certainly leave a lot of room for the critical race theory aspect of things. The one does not need to wipe out the other. So that's what I would go for that. And for Columbus Day, I would like the holiday that has been called Columbus Day to be called Immigrants Day, just celebrating immigrants and their contribution to the country and the history of that, and because we don't have one. We've never had one. It would be more inclusive because really there is no reason why the Italians are the only ones who get a whole paid holiday to themselves. Because, of course, St. Patrick's Day, while it is a big deal, you know, it's not, unless you go to, It's not a paid holiday. It's not a federal holiday. It's not even a Catholic school holiday unless you're in a part of the country that where a lot of the kids in the schools are Irish. No other group, you know, from any continent, you know, gets a paid holiday as part of, you know, celebrating their particular ethnic group's contribution to American society. So I would like to keep the paid holiday, keep it where it is, and make it Immigrants' Day. And then shift, as I said, shift and expand the Native American holidays to November. But let's review again. Why we have Columbus Day as a holiday in the first place, and why it became so specifically tied up with Italian American heritage. Okay, in the period of the maximum European emigration into the United States, which was roughly 1870 to 1920, there were, of course, many immigrants from Italy into the United States, especially from Southern Italy, because the big project of Italian unification did not do a lot for, you know, the people living south of Naples. Or I should say Naples and south, and there are the parts south of there. It probably didn't do a lot for anybody below, you know, the upper bourgeois class, actually. It could be argued, and I would make that argument. I mean, the less money you had in the lower social class was, the less likely it was that you really benefited a great deal from the unification of Italy. And particularly the people in the south didn't, because they were regarded as barbaric, you know, perhaps by nature, perhaps that they couldn't be civilized, that they were not ready for democracy, that they had to be ruled with a firm hand, that they were superstitious, backwards, ignorant. And there also was, of course, the charming racialist aspect to it as well. It's still the case with the fascist parties in Italy, in northern Italy to this day. There's the saying that Africa begins at Naples, which means exactly what you think. And also that, you know, just as I said, the idea that they are just uncivilized, that they can't rule themselves. So that was the idea in Italy. And certainly that idea, you know, pass over to this country when they started coming over in large numbers. And the other part of the 1-2 punch of this is that they were largely Catholic, at least nominally Catholic. And Catholicism was regarded in the 19th century, and it still is today by certain Protestant groups. But in those days, really, it was largely regarded by Protestant Christians in the United States as a dangerous, corrupt cult that largely was involved in sexual trafficking, and especially of women, that and all these places called convents that you weren't supposed to go into were full of sex slaves of the priests, and there were probably some of the monasteries were sex slave boys of the priests. There was a woman who made tours around the country, I mean, Maria Monk, who wrote a book called The Confessions of Maria Monk, and she made a big success of herself on the Chautauqua Circuit, detailing all the sexual atrocities to which she had been submitted during her time, being kidnapped and sexually trafficked in a series of convents. And as I said, this idea continues to this day, and you'll find certain aspects of it, like continuing some of the QAnon propaganda. By the way, the other idea that they had with Catholics general, and this wasn't just of Italians, but it was also true of all the Catholic groups, you know, the Irish and the Poles and the Ukrainians, but was the idea that none of these people could ever be counted upon to be loyal American citizens, because they, by definition, owed allegiance to an absolute monarch in Rome, the Pope. And they had to follow the will of the Pope before they could follow any other law. And on both those counts, Catholics in many ways were regarded kind of, that was the same kind of paranoia that is that we find in the United States around Muslims today. The same kind of weird, you know, projections of sexual excess and, you know, mindless devotion to a absolute leader. And one of the places that had a very, very large number of immigrants from southern Italy was New Orleans. They had a very large Italian immigrant community. They still do to this day. And there is still a lot, of course, Italian influence on the culture there, both musical and culinary and otherwise, if you've ever been there. And in 1891, the police chief of New Orleans, a guy named Hennessy, was shot in the street. And it was believed, somehow a rumor formed, that Italian gangsters had done this. Italian street criminals, street gangsters had done this. So in the wake of this, the cops just did mass raids in Italian neighborhoods and picked up, a few hundred Italian, you know, Italian men and brought them into prison. But that was not good enough for a lot of the folks in New Orleans, non-Italians, who got very worked up and stormed the jailhouse and pulled out a dozen of these guys that they were convinced had, you know, had executed the police chief. And a group of vigilante lynch mob stormed the jailhouse. They pulled out about 20 guys out of the prison. They ended up lynching and, you know, killing 11 of them, and eight of the men survived by hiding at various places inside the jailhouse before. And some of the police were able to come in and sort of break up the rest of the mob action. And on the whole, a lot of the national press was sympathetic to the lynchers rather than to the Italians. The New York Times, for example, commented that these sneaking and cowardly Sicilians, the descendants of bandits and assassins who have transported to this country the lawless passions, the cutthroat practices, and the oath-bound societies of their native country, are to us a pest without mitigation. Our own rattlesnakes are as good citizens as they. Lynch law was the only course open to the people of New Orleans. And yes, you heard me right. That's the New York Times, the paper of record. That was their take on it. That was their take on most things having to do with Italian immigration. And so there was a big uproar among the people of the United States who were more progressive than the editors of the New York Times. And yes, Virginia, such people did exist. And of course, American relations with Italy were strained because of this. And as a result, President Benjamin Harrison agreed to make October 12th Columbus Day, but just for 1892, and it would be a one-time thing just to celebrate, Italian-American friendship and Italian, you know, contribution to the American scene. And under pressure from a lot of Italian American, you know, fraternal organizations, there was a long kind of series of pushes to get this made more official in various parts of the country, and there were Columbus Days, places where Columbus Day was a holiday, places where it wasn't. Franklin Roosevelt did make it a national official holiday in 1934, but it was not a paid holiday. That didn't happen until 1968 when Lyndon Johnson signed that into law. So it is a long tradition, but in a way it doesn't have that long a tradition. And as I've often said before, and as you know, you can see for yourself, I mean, the whole point of focusing on Columbus as a figure is the idea that the Italians, the Italian immigrants, were standing up for the right to be treated as good as anybody else to, you know, be in the country, which is not how they were treated, that some immigrants are better than others, and they were the kind that shouldn't be allowed in. And so their response to this was to say, if Italians aren't good enough to come in, I mean, you chumps wouldn't even be here, you know, if it weren't an Italian discovered the place, maybe bumped into it by accident. You wouldn't even have found it on purpose if an Italian hadn't bumped into it by accident beforehand. And it's named after an Italian. So how can you say that we're not part of the history of the country and part of the basic, you know, warp and woof of the, you know, cultural fabric of the country? And given that that's the case, we, you know, we deserve to be here as much as anyone else. And that's sort of what that is. That's the claim that is being made. And I understand that I've always been very sympathetic to that. But, as I have begun to realize, as I said in recent years, that, you know, they're the only group that really have this. That isn't really, it's not really a great idea. And I really think that we should move it over to an Immigrants Day. Unfortunately, you know, I've been making this speech every single year on this show since in the however many years it's been on, 4 or 5 years it's been on. And I'm afraid it just seems like the tide is against me, and this idea, which I think is a great one, is going to, you know, find its way into the dustbin of history. But all kinds of great ideas that were correct do end up in the dustbin of history. And then sometimes the thing about the dustbin of history is that anybody can dig around it and find something interesting and take it out again. You know, after, you know, a number of years of doing work with peace movements in the Soviet bloc, back when there was one, after the, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and the, you know, the collapse of actual existing socialism, or, you know, quote, socialism, unquote, in that part of the world, ostensibly the big, you know, smart money on was on the idea that, oh, well, socialism just doesn't work. It can't work. I mean, and capitalism is the only way to go, and it's been proven. And now, I mean, try to, you know, meet somebody under 30 who's not a socialist. I mean, it's socialism. Socialism is back, baby. And speaking of socialism, let me give you an introduction to this piece of old-time radio drama we're going to hear. This is going to be an episode of The Cavalcade of America from October 12th, 1942. And it is called The Admiral of the Ocean Sea, based on the biography by Samuel Eliot Morison that had come out, I believe, the previous year and won the Pulitzer Prize. And Morison had written this book because he was part of the Harvard Columbus Project, which involved building full-scale replica boats, you know, the Maria Pinta and the Santa Maria, and sailing them from the Mediterranean to the New World using these boats that I said that were, you know, made the way they would have been at the time, and using only the navigation tools that would have been available to Columbus and his sailors at the time, very much like Thor Heyerdahl and his family did with Kon-Tiki about 15 years later and with the Ra expeditions in 1970. And that is a large reason why this book was so popular. It's still in print, by the way, because it focuses a lot on the more physical details of how the voyage would go, what they would have done in the boat and how the boat worked, how sailing worked if you went by the stars and by an astrolabe and not, you know, you didn't have maps. The other thing to keep in mind, and of course this is Orson Welles and a number of his friends involved in this who will be identified. This is a wartime production. It was October 12, 1942. And it is fascinating how this is presented. It is presented as a wildly romantic adventure, this whole, you know, voyage across the ocean blue. And, it includes Welles doing he reads out a long portion, although only partial, it's a very long poem, of a passage to the Indies by Walt Whitman, which is sort of a part of Walt's rhapsody of the modern world, you know. Not even Jonathan Richman has ever been more in love with the modern world than Walt Whitman was with, you know, the technology of the day, engineering and technology, the whole idea that these kind of voyages will just unite the world and bring everything together, kind of the way that people talk about the internet today, the way they talked about the radio back in the 20s and the 30s and 40s, and television, a very romantic view of the hopefulness of technology and its ability to unite people. There's also a lot of the idea of the Pan-American movement, which was a big idea at this time. You'll notice that when Wells talks about the glories of what Columbus discovered, he is describing not just certainly not just the United States, but not just he's not even describing just North America, but South America as well, and the Caribbean, because this is also part of this idea of the political and cultural, trying to create political and cultural ties between the people of North and South America, a big idea at the time. There was a little closing pep speech from Henry Wallace, who was the vice president of the United States under Roosevelt at the time, later ran for president under the Democratic Party, was pushed out because he was too far to the left, ran as one of the Progressive Party and was defeated because his program was included such crazy things as a push for the desegregation of public schools, for national health care, for racial and gender equality. What a nut, eh? And aside from the work by, that is based on this work by Samuel Eliot Morison, the two writers credited for bringing the, aside from Wells himself, who are credited for, developing this for the show, are first a guy named Norris Houghton, who was a very major figure in the American theater scene, kind of made his name by getting involved, going to the Soviet Union, getting to know Stanislavski and some of the people in the Moscow Art Theater working there. Wrote books on it, became probably the best known person who was the sort of the liaison, cultural liaison between Soviet theater and the United States. And one of the ideas that he began to sort of like percolate in his head when he was there was the idea that focusing on just sort of big money commercial theater, Broadway, in other words, that wasn't a way to keep a real theatrical culture going, here or anywhere else. And so he was very interested in sort of what and other forms of community-based theater, of all sorts. And, meaning school theater, union theater, prison theater, all kinds of things. And was one of the people involved in sort of establishing a real off-Broadway theater community here in New York City, and eventually founded a theater called The Phoenix, which began in the East Village on 12th Street in the early 50s and moved some years later up to the East 70s and shut down in the early 80s. But, he was, he was a left of Roosevelt kind of a guy. And the other person who was the co-writer in this, even more interestingly, was a guy named Robert Meltzer, who was an associate, worked a lot with Wells on a number of things, and worked with Charlie Chaplin, who was, in fact, was an assistant director on The Great Dictator, and some people think he might have, had a hand in the script. And this piece, I look in David Golden, who is his radio file, and this is the only thing that he's, the only radio show he's credited with writing. And sometime around the time, I would imagine a little after this had aired, he enlisted in the army and went, ended up being, fighting in Europe and was killed in action in August of 1944. Also, the Screenwriters Guild established an award in his name, the Robert Meltzer Award, which has been given out for screenwriters who had died in battle, in a good cause. And they give this out for 4 years until 1951, where Hueck, in one of its great brain truster moments, put Robert Meltzer on the blacklist, despite the fact that the guy had been dead for 7 years. Not only had he been dead for 7 years, but he had died, fighting with the U.S. Army, fighting against fascism in Europe. But as I said, this is, clear, kind of typical of the brain power of the people involved in HUAC. Oh, also I forgot. He had worked with Wells on a picture, unfinished picture called It's All True, which was all set to story set in South America and was intended to, you know, encourage and, you know, promote political and cultural, you know, understanding between North and South America. It's just, you know, it's very much, as I said, a part of this Pan-American movement. So all of this is in the piece that we're going to hear here. And is it's quite striking that something that is so romantic about Columbus was put together by people that are, you know, a bunch of premature anti-fascists, people that were, you know, very unambiguously of the American left at that time. Not the way most of us would think about it today. And I found this just fascinating to listen to, and I hope you do too. By the way, this show is A Mansion for the Rat. I'm Anne Marie Hendrickson. You're listening to WBAI-FM, New York. And now on to the Cavalcade of America.
Starring Orson Welles in Admiral of the Ocean Sea on the Cavalcade of America, sponsored by DuPont, maker of better things for better living through chemistry.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles. In an old book in a library in the city of Seville, this is written.
An age shall come after many years when the ocean will loose the chain of things and a huge land lie revealed.
The quotation is from an ancient Roman play by Seneca. An age shall come after many years when the ocean will loose the chain of things and a huge land lie revealed. In the old book in Seville, these lines are followed by this one.
My father fulfilled this prophecy on October 12th in the year of our Lord, 1492.
Today is October 12th, 1942. Hello, Americans. This is our birthday. This broadcast is part of the celebration. It comes to you in the principal American languages, and you're hearing it in every country of our hemisphere. Happy birthday, everybody. Happy birthday. Maybe you'd forgotten.
In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
That's right. 4.5 centuries ago this morning, Columbus found a new world.
Mr. Wells, that's a rather dangerous statement.
Oh, why's that?
It isn't clearly established who first discovered America. I'm a full professor of trobiology and of allergy and critnics.
We're glad to know you, but what about Columbus?
It is not precisely accurate to say that Columbus discovered America. You see, there's every historical evidence to show that the land masses of the Western Hemisphere were discovered many years, I might even say many centuries, before Columbus. To be exact, in the north and east by the Vikings under Leif the Lucky and perhaps Eric the Red.
Oh, yes.
The south and west by natives from the South Seas, traveling in canoes with cocoa nuts for sextants. In the west and north by certain Asiatic peoples.
Yes.
Bridging the Aleutian Islands, and perhaps I might
Professor,
even...
Professor, I agree with you. A lot of men besides Columbus discovered America, probably some before him and many after him. Great names like Magellan, Vasco da Gama, Balboa, the Cabots, Hudson...
Amerigo Vespucci?
That's right, Professor.
For whom this hemisphere is named.
That's right, Professor. Now, here's my point about America's other discoverers. The great and the anonymous. The conquistadors, the priests, the prospectors, the traders, the trappers, the banderantes, and the leather stockings. Every man of them who moved forward valiantly into any part of the uncharted darkness of our new world is a discoverer of America. Every man of these is Columbus, and Columbus is all of them. He's the first man who's going to get to the moon. He's the fellow with the courage of his dreams.
I can fly like a bird. I can sail without a sail.
I can ride my carriage without a horse.
I can get to the east by sailing west.
The sound you've been hearing was laughter. We bring you now the sound of an aeroplane. A steamboat. An automobile. And by the way, it turns out you can get to the east by going west. Because the world is round.
Of course it's round.
Then why did you laugh at Columbus?
Oh, me?
Yes, you. Remember the egg story?
The egg story. The scene is a castle in Spain. Columbus, who has just discovered America, is the guest of honor at a banquet.
With nobody can deny.
Why all this fuss about Columbus?
Yes, why?
After all,
you were discussing me, gentlemen?
Yes, I see you were.
Oh, well, we were merely saying...
And no doubt you were saying that too much is made of my achievement.
We were only remarking, my Lord Admiral.
Yes.
As the world goes, sooner or later, somebody else would have done it.
Sooner or later.
There's not much that I can say to that. But here, you see, I have a hard-boiled egg.
An egg?
Egg?
Hard-boiled?
An hard-boiled egg?
Hard-boiled eggs in the 1490s?
Yes, the poached egg hadn't been introduced yet. It was to be discovered several years later in Mexico by Sister Juana de la Cruz.
He has an egg.
Yes. And I should like to ask you to make this egg stand on end.
Stand on end?
What a curious request.
Here, give it to me.
It rolls over.
Well, of course it rolls over.
Here, let me try.
What's going on?
Wait now, please. This is obviously quite impossible.
Is it impossible?
Yes. Impossible.
Watch. I crack the shell gently on the bottom, and the egg stands.
Oh, of course it stands. Of course.
If you do it that way.
Yes. But nobody else thought of doing it that way.
I like that yarn, because it tells us something about the man himself. He had wit as well as courage, it would seem. Too bad we don't know more about Columbus.
Columbus is not necessarily the correct name. It is given severally as Columbo, Colon, Colum, Columb, and Colonius.
Thank you, Professor. Anyway, he came from Genoa, which makes him Italian.
Well, evidence has been brought forward that he was Corsican or possibly Majorcan.
Oh, well.
Another theory would make him a Greek. There are also claims that he was English, Portuguese, German, French, Jewish, Spanish, and Armenian.
Probably Italian, though.
Indubitably.
Thank you, Professor. Also, everybody seems to agree that his red hair was prematurely gray and that he was freckled.
Well, as to the freckles...
Never mind about the freckles. What we care about is that 4.5 centuries ago today, he arrived on our shores. Christopher Columbus, the admiral of the ocean sea, with 3 ships in his command. Everybody knows their names. The Santa Maria, the Pinto...
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Wells.
Yes, little girl?
The name of the ship was the Pinta, not Pinto.
That's the Pinta. That's right. That's right, little girl. Do you know the name of the other boat?
The other ship was the Nina.
That's what I said.
Columbus set sail from the coast of Spain on August 3rd, 1492. It took him 34 days to cross the Atlantic, if you count from his last port of call, the Grand Canaries.
The Grand Canaries. There's the glamour of voyaging in that name. His last port of call, you said it was. That's the word, all right, call. Call. Baghdad, there's a call to that name. Pango Pango. Timbuktu. The Grand Canaries. Not that the Grand Canaries can have sounded very special to Columbus. Other words quickened his blood and meant adventure. The Indies, Zipangu, the islands of spice, Cathay, the empire of the Great Khan. Oriental places, the fabled East that he sailed west to find. And there were others. Names he'd never heard. Singing names for Europeans after him to learn. Cusco, Chichen Itza, Orinoco, Saskatchewan, Mississippi. Some say that Columbus was only and merely practical. They say all he was after was a shortcut to India. Just that, a shortcut. Maybe. Maybe the unknown can only be explored by men of no imagination, but I think you need imagination to make the try. Can't have been pleasant, that first crossing. Somebody once said that adventure is an attitude taken toward discomfort. Imagine the first day of that first Atlantic adventure.
September 8th, 1492. Here's Columbus ready to up anchor and away, his three caravels dancing in a sharp northeasterly off the Gran Canaries.
My lads, we head away now to the west. There it's still dark, but not quite dark. For look you, hanging low and so bright. See that westering star? I know that star. I know it well. Our course is set by the Star of the North, lad. But we sail toward that one. The star in the west.
Walt Whitman wrote about that voyage. Passage to India, he called his poem. Passage to India. The medieval navigators rise before me. The world of 1492 with its awakened enterprise. Something swelling in humanity now, like the sap of the earth in spring. Passage to India. Struggles of many a captain. Tales of many a sailor dead. The plans, the voyages again. The expeditions, dominating the rest I see, the Admiral himself. History's type of courage, action, faith. The knowledge gained, the mariner's compass, lands found and nations born. Thou born, America, for purpose vast, man's long probation filled, thou rondeur of the world at last accomplished. Passage. Immediate passage. The blood burns in my veins. Away, O soul. Hoist instantly the anchor. Cut the hawsers. Haul out. Shake out every sail. Have we not stood here like trees in the ground long enough? Have we not groveled here long enough, eating and drinking like mere brutes? Have we not darkened and dazed ourselves with books long enough? Sail forth. Here for the deep waters only. For we are bound where mariner has not yet dared to go. And we will risk the ship, ourselves and all. Oh, my brave soul. Oh, father, father, sail. Oh, father, 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 sail.
The gray Azores, behind the gates of Hercules, before him not the ghost of shores, before him only shoreless sea. The good mate said, now must we pray, for lo, the very stars are gone. Brave Admiral, speak, what shall I say? Why say, sail on, and on.
No child grows up in America without hearing again and again the story of that brave first voyage.
My men grow mutinous day by day.
Mutiny.
My men...
Mutiny. None of us got through the fourth grade at school without learning that mutiny was the gravest peril Columbus faced. His men feared to go on, we were told, because they thought their ships would fall off the edge of the world. Perhaps we remember this so vividly because we learned it such a short time after we learned the world had no edge. The sailors believed in great monsters, sea dragons, fish that could swallow whole fleets. And their dread was real to us then, because we'd just been told that dragons don't exist. And we stood with Columbus on these grave questions, on the side of light and logic, by the grace of a mere semester or two. Now, frankly, it isn't easy to reconstruct, to reenact a 15th century mutiny. I don't know how far the mutineers dared to go or got with that clear-eyed gentleman from Genoa. I don't know what they said exactly, but I can guess what it sounded like. Something like this, maybe.
The Nazi war machine is invincible.
Let's face it, he can't be beaten.
We can't hold out against the Nazis.
Now, of course, Columbus's men weren't talking about the Nazis back then. But it was the same kind of talk.
He'll be in Moscow in 2 weeks.
He'll take Russia by telephone.
Hitler is invincible.
You've heard that kind of mutiny. Remember? Well, there were dragons in 1492, and you could slip off the rim of the earth. But we know now that we can beat Hitler, just as sure as the world is round. Thirty-two days out, and 2 days to go, and they nearly turn back. Then, on the 33rd day, Columbus made this entry in his log.
Today, we saw a bird.
How can we understand a moment in time we never experienced? How can we anticipate something that has already happened? Well, let's try. No music, please. And I'm not going to say anything. We'll all just think about it. Try to imagine what it was like on that ship on that night.
All right, Mr. Admiral. Do you see a light there straight ahead?
I think I do. Yes. There it is. Like a little wax candle. It rises and falls. It's a light on land. Or a little boat.
It's gone.
Wait a moment. May return.
Aye.
There it is. I see it too. I see it too. But no.
Alas, it falls along my western star, just ready to set. With a wisp of cloud or some low sea mist that gives it that strange, warm glow like a lamp. That makes it glimmer and then go out.
Better luck next time, Master Christopher.
It's 450 years ago, this morning, 2 o'clock, the three ships speed straight on, their sails shining white in the moon that now has risen past full in the sky behind. Finta leads, a brave trade wind now blows, the caravels roll and plunge and throw the spray as their bows cut down the last invisible barrier that lies between the old world and this new one of ours. A moment now. A moment. And the mirror that rose in remotest antiquity will conclude.
If this be the Indies, then I've done what I set out to do. But if this should not be, who is there now who is able to say this is not a land far greater still? To that land, and the men of that land, I say, and to them who follow them through ages to come, to the sons of this land we see here stretching forth, I say, lock this night in your heart. For on it, a man's dream came true.
Passage to more than India. O secret of the earth and sky, of you, O waters of the sea, O winding creeks and rivers, of you, O woods and fields, of you, strong mountains, of you, O pampas, of you, gray rocks, O morning red, O clouds, O rain and snows, O day and night, passage to you, O sun and moon, and all you stars. Passage to you.
Cook,
Columbus died without ever knowing what he'd found or how much there was of it. Took a long time to find that out. As a matter of fact, we don't know it all yet. There are big sections in our part of the Atlas still marked unexplored. But these things we do know. Our island stretches the length of the world. We have great rivers. The Amazon, the Mississippi, the Orinoco, the Columbia, the Yukon, the Paraguay. We have great mountains, the Andes, the Rockies, the Sierra Madres, the Appalachians. We have lakes, Titicaca, the Great Lakes, the Great Salt Lake. We have the brush of the Mato Grosso, the jungles of the Amazon, the swamps of the Everglades, the deserts of Chile and Arizona, the falls of Niagara and Iguazu. We have timber and quarries and iron. We can build a world. We have coal and oil and water. We can run a world. We have wheat and corn and cattle. We can feed a world. And ours is a tolerant land. Summer and winter live in it side by side. And we're so rich that we can change the tide of history with only a small part of our natural wealth. In the crew of Christopher Columbus was a man who is alive today. I will repeat that. A member of Columbus's crew is alive today. Happy to have him with us here in the studio, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to meet Jose... I'm terribly sorry. Forgotten your name?
I've forgotten the last one myself. Just call me Jose or Joe, whatever you like. Yes, sir, man and boy. I've been around for quite some time.
Well, aren't you having to sign up with Columbus, Joe?
I just happened to be around. Didn't spend much time here at first. None of us did. Made several crossings. Ship with a lot of captains on all sorts of craft. The Mayflower, Half Moon. I've forgotten most of the names. Went all over. Fountain of Youth. Never found that. El Dorado. That never turned up. And those Amazon women. I never saw them. But that peak in Darien.
Well, I suppose you saw a lot of things for the first time, Joe.
Well, a lot to see. Mountains and lakes and rivers. They were always claiming them in the name of the king. I carried the flag. Different flags, of course. Different kings. I don't remember their names either. Billy the Bald, Charlie the Flat, Peter the Evil, or whoever they were. It doesn't matter now.
What made you finally settle down?
I don't know. I got used to it. Didn't seem any sense going back after a while. Nice people around here. Nice country.
What'd you do?
Oh, a little bit of everything. Farmed, prospected. Cut down a lot of trees. Sometimes didn't do any work at all. Just sat around and let somebody else do it for me.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Hunting, fishing, bell ringing.
What?
Bell ringing. There was a time we were always ringing bells.
What for?
Celebrating. You see, we claimed all these countries in the name of the king. But the kings were all too far away to mean much, and after a while, they didn't mean anything at all. So we started doing things in the name of the people. That was a new idea. That's why we rang the bells.
The people. Well, that's something to ring a bell about. And, no, that was another new idea.
Speaking
of
the people, I'd like you to meet a friend of mine.
Oh, how do you do, sir? Your name?
You can call me Joe.
Indian Joe. He's been around a lot longer than I have. Built some beautiful cities back in the old days, didn't you, Joe?
Sure.
He's got something to say. Here it is. A lot of good things came over here from Europe, Africa, and Asia. But a lot of good things were here to begin with. Put them all together... You've got something new.
Sure. Brand new.
Well, that's part of what I was starting to say.
Yeah, I know. I heard Bolivar make a speech about it once. And Henry Clay.
Yeah, but right now, it's really beginning to come true. Americans all over the Americas are honestly anxious now to get to know each other better. To play together and fight together. Let's put it this way. America is being discovered again. This time by Americans. Joe, I think you can start ringing those bells again. Any concluding observation?
Nope. That's it.
Well, everybody in the American hemisphere knows that this new idea we've been talking about has no stauncher friend than Henry A. Wallace, the Vice President of the United States. I went to Washington last week to get his advice on this program, and I also asked him for a few words on its occasion, our American birthday.
And he didn't promise me he'd prepare us something in a day or two and send it along. He simply picked up a pencil and wrote it out for us, there and then. Here it is. The new world in 450 years has transformed the Latin and Anglo-Saxon cultures into what might be called the new democracy. The new democracy looks to the future, not to the past. It looks to the rich soil and bright sunshine of America for strength. It does not exclude the old world, but it will develop its own strength to help the old world. May October 12th be the symbol of new world strength, of the new democracy, of abundance for all the peoples of the earth. Ladies and gentlemen, that about sums it up. Happy birthday again. Many happy returns of the day.
Thank you, Orson Welles. Explorers, those gallant men among our number who must always search out the unknown, who must always cross the misty line of the far horizon, explorers make many kinds of voyages. There are many kinds of explorers. But the discoverers of 1492 and those of 1942 were and are dedicated to one and the same aspiration, to widen the boundaries of man's knowledge. Today, America has a war to win, and all of our efforts are pointed toward its winning. The very urgency we feel that this war must be won springs from our faith that this, our free civilization, free to explore and learn, to improve and progress, is worth fighting for, is humanity's best hope for the future. Our enemies would drag us back into the night of ignorance and fear and poverty. We fight for the freedom to go forward, our freedom of conscience, the freedom of philosophers and artists to bring us added wisdom and beauty, the freedom of scientists to continue the epic voyages of discovery they make within the four walls of their laboratories, enriching the lives of everyone. Not riches of gold and ivory, not the perfume and spice of the fabled Indies, but new standards of health for the youngsters born today. Fuels and metals and plastics to streamline our whole idea of transport. New and better automobiles and airplanes. Maybe transcontinental trains of airborne gliders. New and better houses. Prefabricated, clean, and glistening, of unprecedented beauty and convenience, costing less to build and far less to maintain. Not the rubber Columbus knew as a strange black vegetable gum that seemed to be alive, but instead hundreds of types of rubber. These are only a few of the promises we glimpse just over the horizon of tomorrow's world, thanks to scientific discovery. Not tomorrow's dreams, tomorrow's facts. They are on the way. We fight this bitter war in order to win the peace. We fight, as the president of the DuPont Company recently said, so that the war and the peace will both be victories. Today it is this thought that guides and inspires the men and women of DuPont, who in time of peace work to bring you better things for better living through chemistry. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, Cavalcade will present Madeline Carroll in a new radio play, That They Might Live. It is the story of a young immigrant who a century ago pioneered to emancipate women in the field of medicine, the results of which are being proven today by the gallant efforts of women doctors and nurses devoting their lives to the winning of the war. Next week, Madeline Carroll in That They Might Live. For tonight's program, Cavalcade is indebted to Little Brown and Company, publishers of Samuel Eliot Morrison's Admiral of the Ocean Sea, which was utilized in preparing tonight's play by Mr. Welles in collaboration with Robert Meltzer and Norris Houghton. The orchestra and musical score were under the direction of Don Voorhees. This is Clayton Collier sending best wishes from DuPont.
This program came to you from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.